All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 680. Jason Lingren is with me, and Bibhu Devmisra returns. And we're going to be talking about the Yuga cycles. We'll probably get into comets and other things. Needless to say, if you go outside and look around, I think it's pretty evident that things are changing rapidly. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a very warm good morning.
It is actually warming up here today. It's been so cold, but let's get on with it. Welcome, Bibhu.
Hi, Crow. Hi, Jason. Nice to be back. And we did talk about the Yuga cycle maybe a year and a half back. And so maybe it's a good time to catch up with all that's happening in the world right now and how it lines up with some of the things that I had expected would happen after the Kali Yuga ends in 2025 March.
Okay, so we're going to get into the Yuga, and I'm going to ask Bibhu to actually kind of define it again to bring people up to speed. We had Bibhu on for episode 561 and 567. Bibhu, why don't you take a minute to let folks know where they can find your books, your work, and anything else you want to lay down?
Yeah, the book that I wrote in 2023 was called Yuga Shift, and you can find it on Amazon. It's available in both paperback and there's a Kindle format. And there's also an audio format now. So if you like listening, you can get that as well. It's based on an article that I wrote a long time ago in 2012, where I proposed a new framework, making some modifications to the one that had been developed by Yukteswar. And that particular framework put the end of the Kali Yuga, which is the Iron Age or the last age in this descending cycle of consciousness, in 2025. And then I built up on that article and I published my book in 2023.
Okay, so I'm going to catch people up and then I'm going to ask you to, so we can kind of redefine the Yuga cycle so people know. As far as I know, India holds the best records on long periods of time. Bibhu can correct me if he knows something different than that. But as far as I'm concerned, Indian probably holds the most superior records of the idea of extensive cycles of time. I have covered Sri Yukteswar, who wrote a book, I think it's called Holy Science. Now, in that book that I covered, he said that during the Dark Age, when consciousness was low, people got confused about the length of what a Yuga cycle was. They had it out to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, and he corrected it down to a shorter framework. Probably what Sri Yukteswar did is one of the most popular reckonings of the Yuga cycle, but Bibhu has come in and he's looked at the whole thing. He lives in India. That kind of thinking and that kind of culture is surrounding him as he comes up in the world. So Bibhu, let's jump in. Can we just tell people what the Yuga cycle is? And by the way, do you agree with me that India probably holds the most complete record on ideas of large cycles of time?
Yes, we do. We do have very extensive documentation. A lot of these ancient texts, which were destroyed in the Western world when the Library of Alexandria was burned down. And even in India, there was this vast library at a place called Nalanda. And that library was the largest of its time at around 600 AD. That was also burned down. So we have also lost a lot of documents, but thankfully, a lot of them have also survived. But over the course of the Kali Yuga, there was a lot of distortions which crept into those documents, whatever survived. And that's the reason why people started believing in a Yuga cycle that runs into millions of years. What happened was that the 12,000-year cycle was multiplied by 360, and then it turned into a cycle of 404,032,000 years or something like that. So Sri Yukteswar, he said that, no, the cycle has two components. One is a descending cycle of consciousness of 12,000 years, which is followed by an ascending cycle of another 12,000 years. So that adds up to a 24,000-year cycle, which is very close to the duration of the precession cycle of the Earth, which is around 25,800 years. It's not exactly equal, but pretty close. And that makes it more convincing because a cycle like that, which is, by the way, known to most ancient cultures, Greeks knew it as the Great Year or the Cycle of the Ages, or the Hopi referred to it as the four previous worlds. Vastic call it the four suns, and so on. So it was known to all the ancient cultures. No ancient culture actually believed that time flows in a linear manner. That came up in the 19th and 20th centuries. Every culture believed in a decline of consciousness followed by an ascent in consciousness. And Yukteswar's framework was also appreciated for a couple of other reasons. Firstly, even in the natural cycles of time, we see that in the course of a complete day and night cycle, the intensity of sunlight will gradually decline for 12 hours and then gradually increase over the next 12 hours. And same is true for the cycle of seasons, where the intensity of sunlight increases from January to, let's say, June or July, and then declines afterwards. So intuitively, the cycle made a lot of sense. And that when I first came across Yukteswar's model, I was relieved that it makes sense and it ties in with the known history to a large extent, and as well as the precession cycle. But the reason why I felt that it can't be the correct interpretation was firstly because there was a discrepancy between the duration of the cycle of 24,000 years versus the precession cycle of 25,800 years. And Cicero, he had mentioned that the duration of the precession cycle is around 12,954 years. So a double of that is around 25,800 years. So he knew that the cycle is tied to the precession cycle. I'm sorry, the great year duration was 12,954 years. So he knew that the precession cycle is around 25,800 years. That knowledge was there, but these two durations did not match exactly. The other point is that in Yukteswar's framework, the Kali Yuga ends by 1600 AD. And then there's a 100-year period of transition. So by 1700 AD, Kali Yuga is completely over. And then we get into Dwapara Yuga, which is the ascending cycle. And that didn't make sense to me because the Yuga cycle talks about the gradual decline and improvement of consciousness. And if you look at the last 200-odd years, I think from the perspective of consciousness, we have declined even further. I mean, there's more greed, more narcissism, more hatred, and more violence in the world than there was even 100 years ago. So the decline has continued for the past 200, 300 years. So we couldn't have come out of the Kali Yuga. So that didn't make any sense. And secondly, there are a lot of prophecies which are tied up with the end of the Kali Yuga or the Iron Age. And every culture has those prophecies that there's going to be a period of cleansing, there's going to be revelations, the veil is going to be lifted, we are going to interact with interdimensional entities. And none of that really happened in the last 300 years or so. So that didn't make any sense. The prophecies were not fulfilled, the decline in consciousness is still continuing. So I thought that there's a need to have a relook at that framework. And that's how I started working on it.
All right, so to catch people up, as you can see, Bibbu is well-researched. He's even referencing people like Cicero from Rome. But what he's basically said here is the idea that Sri Yukteswar put down was that the Kali Yuga ended in 1600, right, Bibbu?
Yeah.
So 1600, there's the idea that there's a transfer period, which is sometimes described as 100. I've seen it described as 300, but here we're using 100. The idea that he put forward would be by 1700 AD that we should be clear of the Kali Yuga. But Bibbu, in that reckoning, that means there is no ascending Kali Yuga?
The ascending Kali Yuga ends in 1600.
Okay, so to frame it up, the Kali Yuga is equivalent to what we would probably call the Iron Age or the Dark Age. It's split in two, so half of it is descending and the other half of it is ascending. What he's saying is we got completely free all the way through the downside and the upside in 1600, and Yukteswar put forward that we'd be totally clear of it in 1700. What I wanted to ask you, Bibbu, is I thought about this too when I read about the prophecies, and I thought, well, it doesn't feel like our consciousness is lifting over the period of time we're talking about. Do you feel like social engineering in places like Tavistock could actually push humanity against what the Yuga cycle is supposed to produce?
No, because if we are really in the ascending cycle, that kind of social engineering cannot take place at all. So it's not as if we can act against these kind of natural mechanisms.
Right.
So it never made sense to me that Kali was over and the prophecies were not fulfilled.
So I agree with you. It's a bit like throwing someone in the rapids of a river, and because they can swim better than someone else, they could go against the rapids. That's kind of how I view it. The energies wouldn't provide for that. So the way that you've refashioned, you have the idea that the Kali Yuga, completely the end of the Kali Yuga, was last year at the spring equinox, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's interesting about the work you've done is when I look back to the 1600s like you did, it felt like we were declining the whole time. I mean, we can go back to even the 1800s and see the beautiful furniture and books and just everything that was being created. And it gets worse and worse and worse as we go along. Even in the 1900s, if you look at the car industry in America, in the 60s, there are all these gorgeous cars and they're heavy duty. We get into the 80s, they're all plastic. It's not an improvement, but I do notice a consciousness shift in a positive direction over the past couple years, at least. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, sure. And that is something that I was expecting, and I'm pretty, I would say, pleasantly surprised that this kind of a transformation is happening globally. I think a lot of people are now being able to see through the deceptions and the lies. They're making an effort to find out the truth about our origins and about the nature of our reality. They're more opening to exploring new topics, metaphysical topics, exploring the past, trying to read the ancient philosophies, use them as guiding principles for our lives. So that is already happening. And I think I was expecting it to happen at a more accelerated pace after 2025. And it sure is happening right now.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned one of the prophecies was the idea that we would contact people who aren't from Earth that you might call an alien or extra dimensional. What's interesting about that is you predicted this, and there's actually murmurs from the governments around the world that they're going to do disclosure. And what's even more so is the top producer in Hollywood, or one of the top filmmakers in Hollywood, is actually putting out a movie called Disclosure. Pretty quick.
Yeah, but I'm not so sure if the government is getting involved, how much of the truth is going to come out. But the fact is that there are a lot of catalogs out there. I mean, the Humcat, for example, which has been put together by a group of researchers. Then there's Albert Roussel's Humanoid Sightings Catalog. These researchers, what they have done is they have taken newspaper clippings, magazine clippings from many different sources across the world. And if you read those accounts, it's kind of very strange and mind-boggling about what has been actually going on in all of these very remote locations and people having these kind of encounters, which are inexplicable from the perspective of how we perceive our reality.
Well, I think you and I agree that the government, whatever disclosure they do, it will be attached to an agenda. But it feels to me when you have Hollywood and the government in America lining up to claim disclosure, they're doing it probably because they have to. But what I always say to everyone is the moment you detect fear in their narrative, you should understand that it's not legitimate in its information.
And in fact, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to promote the narrative that these are all demons and evil and you should avoid these kind of encounters. And that's one. And then if you read some of the recent reports from FBI, they're very cleverly put in information about Buzz Aldrin making a UFO sighting when he was near the moon or something. So they're trying to create the impression that the moon landing was real. So they're putting in fake information along with some truthful information.
Exactly. They can't help themselves. Their lies never go away. They have to keep servicing them. But I mean, it goes without saying, we know that NASA doesn't tell the truth. We know that our government doesn't tell the truth. Unfortunately, human beings are very good at forgetting things like that. It's beyond me why people accept anything from these organizations, because they lie for a living, basically. But what are some of the other things that you wrote about over a year ago that you expected to see that are starting to show themselves now?
Yeah, so what happens during this period of transition out of one yuga into the next is that it's a time of chaos and turbulence overall, because the older structures, they are kind of in a state of decay and they are about to fall apart due to a host of reasons. And at the same time, there are new ideas are emerging, new philosophies and new beliefs and new ways of living are also emerging. So it's a time of turmoil and chaos. And what I thought, what I predicted was, first, we are going to see a lot of wars break out, because typically in a yuga ending period, you're going to see battles being fought. And that's because all of that negative aspect of our shadow self that comes to the surface, it's a time of surfacing of our ego self. And it's also a time of surfacing of the truths which have been held down for a long time. So all of that will come to the surface. And because of that, there's more fighting and more discord, which is something that has been happening over the last year. There has been a lot of disclosures. I predicted disclosures will happen and governments will begin to lose some of their power. Their narratives will get challenged. Their plans will not work as well as they did in the past. And that's also happening. I thought that there's going to be a lot of environmental effects as well, because during these periods of transition, our planet itself begins a process of self-cleansing. And that's why you might see more volcanic eruptions, more earthquakes, more wildfires, more storms and floods. And we've seen a lot of that in the last year as well. And I also thought about evolution of this new consciousness being maturing, appearing and maturing, and a common planetary consciousness coming up, and where people are more concerned with the welfare of everyone rather than their own subset of people. And it's good to see that is also happening as well. So the collapse and the emergence are happening in parallel right now, although it's probably the collapse of the old order that's going to be more prominent, because that's going to be flashed on the news channels everywhere, whereas emergence is happening more silently in the minds of people. It's happening in small groups. So that's going to be under the radar for some time now.
I'm so glad you put it the way you just put it. The way that I've been trying to describe the period that we're leaving and the period that we're going into is the period we've known all our life was like service to self, lower vibration. And where we're headed would be better described as service to others. And you said almost that exact thing.
Yes, because the declining cycle of consciousness is when we move away from soul identification and we move towards ego identification. So we become more obsessed with our own egoic needs and our selfish desires, and we are willing to compromise on our morality. We are willing to throw away that moral compass in order to get whatever we want. So that's the ego-dominated consciousness of the descending cycle. But when we move out of that cycle and we move into the ascending cycle, that's when there's this impulse to move out of ego consciousness and go back into self-consciousness or soul consciousness, which is basically heart-centered consciousness. And once you start doing that, then there is more contentment, there's more peace, there's more love, there's more joy, there's more truth, there's justice, there's brotherhood. So all the virtues of the soul or the self begins to manifest in the higher cycle. And so what we are probably going to see now are the first manifestations of that soul consciousness.
So as you marked the end of the Kali Yuga last year at the spring equinox in March, is that the total end, or is there a 100-year transition still to come?
Yeah, that's a thing about the cycle is that, see, there's a 12,000-year cycle, the descending cycle, and a 12,000-year ascending cycle. And these two cycles are separated by an extended period of transition. When we ended the Golden Age at around 10,900 BCE, we went through an extended period of transition, which the Greeks called cataclysmos, or which means deluge. So that was the time that the Great Flood had happened. And scientists have found out that there was a 1200-year period, which they call the Younger Dryas period, when temperatures across the world plummeted and came down to glacial conditions. It was a freezing cold, and there were also comet impacts at that Younger Dryas boundary, which killed off the Ice Age megafauna and also many of the existing civilizations of that time. So we went through that 1200 period of Younger Dryas, which the Greeks called cataclysmus or deluge. And now that we are ending not only the Kali Yuga, but the entire descending cycle of consciousness is coming to an end. So we are now going through an extended period of transition, which again the Greeks called ekpyrosis, which means burning or conflagration. So this is a time that the world is cleansed by fire. So it's a 1200-year period of transition, and it might feel kind of scary to think that we'll be thrown in the furnace for 1200 years. But that's not how it works. When I looked into the ancient prophecies and some of the text in more detail, what I found is the actual shift will be only for a short duration of time between 2025 to 2040. So it's like a 15-year window of change. Very intense, dramatic change.
I'm sorry, how many years?
15 years from 2025 to 2040. A period of very intense, dramatic transformation will happen in this time period, which is really an eye blink, a geological eye blink compared to the entire duration of the cycle. And after that, from 2040 onwards, there's going to be 1,000 years of peace, which has been mentioned not only in the Revelation, but also in the Tibetan Kalachakra Tantra, which is the Tibetan Buddhist text about the time cycles. And the Kalachakra Tantra, in turn, was imported from India. So it's also an Indian text, which tells us that there's going to be 1,000 years of peace following this intense period of transformation. So the entire period of ekpyrosis is not going to be a time of cataclysm. There might be earth changes for the entire duration, but I don't think that's going to impact us to all that extent, because the consciousness is going to change dramatically after 2040.
Well, I think we're already kind of seeing natural events. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, over this last week, they've been reporting earthquake swarms. There's a super El Nino forming, apparently. And didn't somebody prophesize for a massive earthquake and a tsunami over by Japan for 26?
Yeah. There's this Japanese manga artist. So she prophesied last year in 2025. She said that there's probably going to be an earthquake and tsunami in 2025, sometime in August or September. And a lot of people had actually canceled their plans to visit Japan during that time, because that prophecy became so popular. And we did have an earthquake and a tsunami, but the tsunami was a minor one. It had waves of around 5 feet or something. So that prophecy did turn out to be true, but not entirely true. And she has also prophesied that in 2026, between the months of, I think, June and September, there's going to be a Nankai mega thirst earthquake in Japan, which is one of those fault lines. And that's going to cause a tsunami and inundation over large parts of Japan. So that's something that could happen this year. And if you look at all the volcanoes which have suddenly started going off in Philippines and in Indonesia and elsewhere, it looks like there's increased magma activity going on right now.
In my old backyard, I might even be in San Diego County. If not, it's just to the east of San Diego County in the desert. Over the past week, they've been reporting, I think, hundreds, if not thousands, of minor earthquakes, and that usually leads into something, although I haven't followed it very closely. But there's also a prophecy for this year about a star, a red star.
Yeah, that comes from
Chris Bledsoe, I think.
Yeah, from Bledsoe. And he's written a book called UFO of God. And the story of Bledsoe is that he was a rich guy. He was suffering from Crohn's disease. And then he had interactions with these orbs. And these orbs, within these orbs, he could see some dwarf-like humanoid beings. And these orbs apparently cured him of his Crohn's disease, which was a long-standing disease. And later, a lady, some kind of a spectral lady, a lady of light, she appeared before him, and she gave him a lot of messages for the future. And one of them was a prophecy that there's going to be a red star, which is going to line up with the eye line of the Sphinx just before dawn, sometime this year. And when that event happens, there's going to be a new knowledge or new wisdom that will be coming into our planet.
Is the idea that it's a star that we don't see right now, or that it's a star that turns red?
Yeah, she said the red star Regulus. Now, the Regulus is a star in the Leo constellation, but it's a blue star. So the question is, how would Regulus appear red? And one of the ways I'm looking at it is she might have meant a red comet, because comets were known as stars. The term comet itself means a hairy star. And the ancient cultures, they always used to refer to comets as stars. So if a comet, when it moves around the sun, it might appear in the horizon just before sunrise. And that could be a sign of new wisdom, because comets have always been regarded as heralds of impending change and transformation.
Well, it's a little confusing when I read it, because if I'm not mistaken, Regulus is one of the royal stars, the heart of the lion, and I'm pretty sure that's a whitish blue star, brilliant whitish blue. So if a star like that turned red, that would be a pretty big deal, unless, like you say, it's a comet or something else. And by the way, Rose just did a quick lookup. There's approximately 1,350 potentially active volcanoes worldwide right now. 500 of those have erupted historically, and at any given time, roughly 40 to 50 are continuing to erupt. So I guess there's a lot of possibility in volcanoes as well, as you mentioned. That's a lot, 1,350.
Yeah, typically you have anywhere between 40 to 70 eruptions in a year, but last year you had more than 70, so it was more than average. We'll have to see what happens this year.
So one thing I've been keeping my eye on is comets. I think comets are a big deal, and I think the descriptions we've been given for comets are not even close to what's accurate. And I actually read your paper comparing comets to flagella, and I was just so impressed, Bibu. It was such a well-written piece. The examples were well done. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, the thing about comets is that scientists tell us that they are basically frozen balls of ice, right?
Yep.
But if you take a frozen ball of ice and you take it out to space and you keep it there, it's not going to move towards the sun. There's no gravity in outer space. So if you keep a ball of ice out there, it's just going to move in the same direction that you placed it, with the same initial velocity. So if you're directing it towards Pluto, it'll just go towards Pluto. It's never going to turn towards the sun. So please explain to me how an interstellar comet, which has no gravitational binding to our sun, moves towards the sun. How can it move towards the sun when there's no gravity in outer space?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. But again, it's just dead matter to them. And I don't agree with that in the least. I think there's consciousness in all of it. But when I looked at what you did, you even went so far as to compare the tails of comets and their motion and their structure to what we see in flagella, which are the little microscopic organisms we can look at. And it was astonishing to see the correspondence. To be honest, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, see, what happens in a comet is that in many comets, you have multiple tails, right? And sometimes one of these tails will have striations on them. So it'll appear like the feather of a bird. It can have striations on only one side of the stalk, or it might have striations on both sides. So it looks like the feather of a bird. So how can that kind of a structure be formed, very complex and intricate structure, be formed by gas being randomly blown off the surface of a comet? imagine gas coming out of the chimney of a house. Does it form that kind of structure? Will it ever form that kind of structure? And then you take into consideration that a comet is moving through space at extremely high speeds of, on an average, it moves at 50 kilometers per second. And sun-grazing comets move at around 500 kilometers per second. So how is it supposed to maintain that shape throughout its journey? On the other hand, exactly same kind of tail structures can be seen in microscopic organisms like algae and bacteria. They have these flagella, and a flagella might just be like a, you know, like a whip, just an extended structure, or it might have these slight feather-like structures coming out of it, hair-like structures. So it looks exactly like the kind of tail structures that comets have. And when I first looked at that similarity, I was astonished. I mean, each and every tail structure of an algae can be mapped to the tail structure of comets. And there's this Chinese comet Atlas, which was made during the Han era, around 600 BCE. And that comet Atlas has a number of comets depicted. And each of those comets have multiple tails, and some of those tails have these feather-like structures on them. And you can see that they actually look like algae and bacteria, the way we describe them in our biology textbooks. And then I found out that not only do comets have tail structures exactly like algae, comets also rotate on their axis as they move towards the sun, which is also something that algae do. What they do is that they have an eye spot, and using that eye spot, they move towards the light source. And the reason why they do that is because they need to photosynthesize. So you know that most of the oxygen that is generated in our planet comes from the plankton, and the dominant organism in that plankton are algae. And what the algae do is that they are constantly moving in circles near the water surface, because they're moving towards the light source, they photosynthesize there, and they go down back again, and they again come up. And comets are doing the same thing. They're moving towards the sun in a particular orbit. That means that maybe comets are also trying to photosynthesize. Why else would it go towards the sun and move away in a separate direction? So both the movement and the nature of their behavior began to make sense to me. And then we also know that comets don't always move in the same track. Sometimes they'll be found in a specific point in their orbit, and the next day you find that it's gone somewhere else. And that can happen in case a comet is conscious, not if it's following a specific trajectory. They can increase or decrease their speeds. They change their direction of rotation and their speed of rotation. So all of that is something that microscopic organisms also do. And there's more. For instance, comets have been seen to be, we've seen that they break up into multiple fragments. Sometimes that happens when they are very far from the sun, and sometimes it happens when they're close to the sun. So a comet fragments into multiple comets. Now, if a comet is made up of frozen ice and it breaks apart, what exactly is supposed to happen? The entire contents of the comet is supposed to get vaporized, especially if it happens close to the sun. Instead, you end up with a dozen other comets. How does that happen? Well, because in microscopic organisms, they reproduce by means of binary fission or multiple fission. So in a binary fission, an algae will break up into two daughter cells, which are exactly identical. In multiple fission, it creates a cyst around it. And then within that cyst, the nucleus keeps on dividing until there are maybe a few dozen daughter cells. And then that cyst breaks up, and all of those daughter cells are released out in the open. So, and that is exactly what is happening with comets. They are breaking up. Sometimes they break up into two identical comets, and sometimes they break up into multiple comets. So they are even following the model of replication in unicellular organisms. And there's more. Do you want me to continue, or do you have
it? Yeah, definitely. I think people should go look at the work Bibu has done with this, because the correspondence is almost jaw-dropping. But yes, please, go ahead.
Yeah, and the final question that I had was, how do you explain all of these different kinds of gases which are coming out of comets, right? We have water vapor, this carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, this oxygen. Then 3i Atlas was giving out iron and nickel vapors. And there are many other kinds of organic molecules, ethyl alcohol. All of that comes out of a comet. And scientists are saying that, oh, maybe there's a frozen form of ethyl alcohol. There's a frozen form of iron and nickel vapor. 3i Atlas was giving out iron and nickel vapor when it was near the orbit of Jupiter. And you just don't form metallic vapor at those temperatures. There are comets which give out water when they're very, very far from the sun, and ice does not sublimate in those temperatures. So what's going on? So what I realized was that since comets are biological organisms, they also have metabolic reactions going on inside them. And all of these gases, they are released as a result of these metabolic reactions. For instance, when the scientists went very close to comet 67P, you remember that Rosetta spacecraft, and they tried to fake that landing?
Yeah, I covered the whole thing, then showed how they faked it. But please, go ahead.
Yeah, but they got close enough to take a good look at the coma of the comet, and they found molecular oxygen. Now, molecular oxygen is not produced by any other process in the universe other than photosynthesis. And not only that, molecular oxygen is so unstable, it simply does not exist in space. Scientists have never found molecular oxygen anywhere in space, but they found it in the coma of 67P. So the question they should have been asking is this comet photosynthesizing? But they never asked that question because they are completely fixated on the belief that it's a frozen ball of ice. So my point is that it's releasing oxygen because it's photosynthesizing. And that's the reason why so many comets appear green, because they have chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is the dominant pigment in those comets. And we know that chlorophyll makes a plant look green because it reflects only the green light and it absorbs the rest.
I'm sorry, I got to jump in here. This was one of the big questions I had. When I came up learning astronomy in the 90s, I got to a point where I could look at a picture of any comet that had been imaged in the last 100 years or more, and I could tell you what comet it was. And I started shooting comets. As a matter of fact, when I got my first big telescope, Hale-Bopp was in the sky. But here's the thing. Up to that point, comets were usually white. There might be a little blue, even a little yellow. Occasionally, there might be a hint of green, but almost non-existent on the green. It would be much more likely to see a bluish or something like that. Around the year 2000, damn near every comet that I saw or I saw other people imaged or that I imaged was green. And for a long time, I had this question up to the point that I read your paper. That is the first explanation that's even acceptable at any level that I've heard. Were you aware of that? That comets being green wasn't even a thing until about the year 2000?
No, I didn't know about that particular changeover.
What if that too is, obviously connected to the Yuga cycle and the lifting of consciousness and life?
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. I mean, I don't really know what's going on, all the things that are going on with comets, but they're certainly living. And the reason why they're coming close to the sun is because they want to photosynthesize. And they also want to replicate, because once they have that energy, that's when they can replicate. They can't replicate in very cold and dark conditions. That's why you find that a lot of comets, when they come close to the sun, all of a sudden it's fragmenting into a dozen or more comets.
Well, I'm just happy that you've taken the time to go against the idea that it's just dead matter. We have records going back to almost forever of what other cultures thought about comets. But much of the time, they thought something bad was going to happen when they saw a comet. There are ample examples of rulers changing when comets show up. And I know you're familiar with that to some degree.
Yeah, sure. I mean, comets were always looked upon as signs of impending disaster. It's like a sign of the wrath of God. And they were associated with all kinds of disaster, wars and plagues and death of kings and famines. All kinds of disasters were associated with comets. And it's not any single culture. I mean, if you read the Greek writers, If you read the Chinese Comet Atlas, and if you look at other native societies, you'll find that all of them thought that whenever a comet comes, something big and drastic happens. But there are some comets which are also associated with good things, which bring prosperity and fertility and abundance. We have a text in India where a sequence of 26 comets are described, which struck us during the Younger Dryas period from 10,900 to 9,700 BCE. And some of those comets bring negative consequences, whereas some of them are associated with health and abundance and prosperity. So comets can also bring good things for us. And they're also associated with the birth of good kings and prophets and sages. For instance, the Star of Bethlehem was most probably a comet which was visible in the daylight, and because of which it could be followed. And comets can also suddenly become stationary in the sky over an area, because Josephus writes about a comet that stood over the city of Jerusalem for a whole year in the year 66 AD or something, which again tells you that that can't be a ball of ice moving due to gravitation. It can't suddenly stop. It can stop only by its own free conscious will. So that kind of information also tells you that comets are associated with the birth of kings and prophets.
Which is not just a wish. That's been confirmed many times over. And like you said, it's not just some cultures. Most of the major cultures that have left us something that we can read now have had to say about comets. And it's pretty clear that when a comet shows up, there's going to be change. But even in our culture, where we have places like NASA trying to convince us everything's made up of dead matter, even they have gone down the road of saying that possibly they're seeding DNA and things like this. But that's one thing I've got my eye open for this year is comets. And next, I'm expecting that we'll see something. And actually, in the Sky and Telescope magazine, they're boasting that this could be a good year for comets, yet that has yet to materialize.
We did have a couple of comets this year, but nothing very spectacular. I'm waiting for a comet that we can see with the naked eye, and particularly in the daytime, because that kind of comet generally has a stronger influence on things that happen on Earth.
Right. When I got my first telescope, Hale-Bopp was visible in the daytime in the western sky. And I was disappointed because I finally had this great optical tool. And when I looked at the comet, it was so disappointing. And that's when I learned. And that's also why I suspect they're not as far away as we're being told. As a matter of fact, I strongly suspect Tycho Brahe put forward information on comets that we didn't get our hands on. But to get back to the point, if you see a comet and you use a pair of binoculars, almost always it will be a much better view than through a telescope, just because of the nature of comets. But in the predictions of all these comets, each year they keep acting like there's going to be the comet of the century. And the definition of that is exactly what you're saying, one that we can see in broad daylight. And everyone keeps hoping for that next comet of the century, as they label it.
Yeah, and it could be, because one of the things that I found out is that comets also play a very important role in these periods of transition between the ages. There's a lot of comets come very close to the Earth. They can cause cataclysms, and they can also seed us with new DNA. They can seed with water, because all the water that we have on Earth, most of it, are, if not all of it, came from comets. Because the ratio of heavy water to normal water in our oceans is same as the ratio of heavy water to normal water inside comets. So they were probably responsible for bringing water as well. And we know that they give out so many different kinds of organic molecules. That's because they're living. Organic molecules are only created by living organisms. We create a lot of organic molecules. When we die, our bodies turn into organic molecules. So if comets are giving out so many different kinds of organic molecules, it means these are generated as a part of their metabolic reactions going on inside them, like photosynthesis, like cellular respiration, because of which it's generating water and carbon dioxide, like nitrogen fixation, because of which it generates methane and other gases. Then also the degradation of photosynthesis, because of which it generates carbon monoxide. So when you compare the plankton to comets, there's like a one-to-one match. But I don't know how many people would be willing to look deeper into this or to take it up, because this is something that most people, I would think, would think it's too woo-woo to believe in.
I think we're coming into a time where so many things that we thought were woo-woo are actually true, that what you've written here may actually get some traction. Just the color thing that you've put down alone is very interesting to me, because for years I've been questioning, why the heck are all comets green? I was even doing things like, is it the digital cameras that became so, popular around the turn of the century? But what you put forward is very interesting. I know certainly that when a comet comes around, that there's change. It's almost like an upgrade to a computer system in a weird way. I accept that there's consciousness there. That is not dead matter in my eyes. But when you started to compare it to the flagella, you can see the one-to-one correspondence in simply how they form and how they look. So to put it briefly, I think what you've written here may get some traction later on, Bibu.
Yeah, I hope so, because there's a lot of connections, and we simply have to stop thinking of everything out there as being dead matter. I think there's consciousness everywhere in our universe, even in the center of a galaxy. The galactic core is also conscious. It's not a black hole out there. That's the galactic consciousness, or the supreme creative consciousness, if you want to call it. That's what the Vedic sages refer to as Brahma, the unmanifested creator who brings everything out of him. That's what the Christian mystics refer to as the Christ consciousness, which activates our heart center. That's what the Native Americans called the Great Spirit, who breathes life into everything. So that's really the source of creation of souls. That's where we come as souls, and that's where we go back after we have completed our cycle of incarnations. So that's the center point of our cosmos. That's the God in the center of the universe that so many traditions talk about.
Well, it's going to be interesting if we do get something that's actually red in the sky that's near Leo the Lion, the constellation, particularly if it's red. I don't think I've ever seen a red comet. As a matter of fact, I'm reasonably sure I haven't. And I can't imagine that the blue star would become red, but I guess anything's possible. So I'll definitely be keeping my eyes open for that. Do you have anything more you want to add about comets?
Well, 3I Atlas was changing its color, and they were talking about it a lot. It changed from brownish red to green and then back to blue. And algae do that as well. They change their colors from green to blue to red. That's why they're called blue-green algae, because they keep changing their colors so that they can absorb different wavelengths of light. Maybe that's what 3I Atlas was doing. It was changing its dominant pigment so that it can absorb different wavelengths of light, and therefore manufacture different kinds of cellular requirements, whatever that is.
Well, it also changed direction too, right?
Yeah, it also changes. Comets do that all the time. They change their directions all the time. And they're always saying that, oh, there might have been some gravitational perturbation from somewhere. No, where's the gravity? First of all, there's no gravity in outer space. Secondly, all of these planets are so far away. Nothing should be altering its trajectory. Does our planet Earth change its trajectory ever? Because we're gravitationally bound to the sun. So we are always stuck in a fixed orbit. But these things, they're not gravitationally bound. They can move wherever they want.
Well, it doesn't make sense, because what they tell us is it's dead matter basically falling through space. Right. So when it started to do things, what did they do? They tied it to the scary aliens that aren't our friends narrative and things like this.
Yeah, they basically don't have any clue what's happening with comets. So they're coming up with any kind of explanation. But every time a comet comes close to the sun, there'll be like a dozen anomalies, which they'll find out. They'll say that, we don't know how this is happening or that is happening. And then all of those anomalies will get brushed on the carpet. And the next one comes along, again, they have started with their basic thesis that it's a ball of ice. So it never changes. A new theory has to come and replace that so that they stop bringing it up over and over again.
Yeah, I suspect they know full well what comets are, but they're busy pushing the materialist agenda where everything is just dead matter. But we are coming to the top of the first hour. Bibu, can you please tell folks one more time where they can find your book and your works, And by the way, is this paper posted for people, the ecpyrosis paper?
Yeah, it's on my website. So if you go to my name, bibhudevmishra.com, my website's name is Ancient Enquiries. So you can search using that, or you can just go to www.bibhudevmishra.com. You'll get the articles there. And my book, as I said, is called Yuga Shift, and it's on Amazon, and you can get it in Kindle and paperback and audio version.
So I would recommend people go look at the paper that he wrote, the article called 1 Year of Ecpyrosis. That's the first part of the title, and down in it is the comparison of comets to living things. And I think it's a astounding piece of work, and I love it because it thinks outside the box. And to me, that's what we should all be doing right now. This brings us to the top of hour one of episode 680. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crrow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to everything. The comments, the forums, they get to screen the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon that has 10 awards in the world. It's done very well. Last 2 awards actually came from India. And they get exclusive access to my solar work. It's been difficult getting out, but we're coming into a warmer part of the year, so that will probably pick up in earnest very quickly. With that, we're going to take a short break and come back for hour 2. And I'd like to wish everybody, everywhere, a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.